The seismic Supreme Court ruling on presidential immunity that could shape America for years to come.
There is a principle that nobody is above the law, and it has always been understood that the president himself has to abide by the law. This opinion, not only does it grant this immunity, but it grants the immunity in some really sweeping ways, I think go far beyond anything anybody could have assumed.
Plus, thousands of Palestinians displaced multiple times already are ordered to relocate once again.
The latest order is a sign that Hamas has managed to regroup, and we could soon see Israeli forces moving back into Khan Yunis and a resumption of heavy fighting.
And the European leader with the closest ties to Russia meets with Ukraine's president in a rare visit to Kyiv. Today is July 2nd, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Lori London. Israeli forces bombarded several areas of southern Gaza Tuesday, and thousands of Palestinians fled their homes in what could be part of a final push of Israel's intensive military operations in 9 months of war. Associated Press correspondent Yosef Fetterman reports.
The Israeli military has ordered a mass evacuation from a large part of the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis. This isn't the first time we've seen an evacuation order like this. Israel spent several months inside Khan Yunis battling Hamas before withdrawing earlier this year. The latest order is a sign that Hamas has managed to regroup, and we could soon see Israeli forces moving back into Khan Yunis and a resumption of heavy fighting.
AP correspondent Yosef Fetterman. Gaza's European hospital in Khan Yunis is virtually empty, with staff and patients fleeing after the Israeli army's orders for residents in the surrounding areas to evacuate. UNRWA spokesperson Louise Waterridge.
UNRWA estimates that around 250,000 people have been impacted by these orders. Of course, as usual, we expect these numbers to grow. But, you know, for us, this is it's another devastating blow to the humanitarian response here. It's another devastating blow for the people and the families on the ground. It seems that they are forcibly being displaced again and again. You know, making these decisions is now impossible.
Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken affirmed Monday that President Joe Biden's proposal to end the Israel-Hamas conflict is achievable and urged Hamas to accept it. Blinken also underlined the importance of post-war plans to rebuild Gaza and prevent a security vacuum in the territory. VOA's Veronica Balteras Iglesias reports.
As Israeli troops continue deepening their incursions in Gaza in search of militants, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced Monday that Hamas's military capabilities have almost been eliminated.
We are advancing to the end of the phase of eliminating the terrorist army of Hamas, and there will be a continuation to strike its remnants.
The announcement was made as U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, in an interview at the Brookings Institution in Washington, called on Hamas's leadership to accept a phased peace proposal currently on the table.
I think the proposal that President Biden put forward is achievable. And it would be the best way forward, the quickest way to end the conflict in Gaza, to stop the violence, to massively surge assistance, to get everyone home, including American hostages.
As the secretary spoke, the voices of protesters gathered outside the Brookings Institution could also be heard. Blinken, who didn't acknowledge them, stressed that the Israel-Hamas conflict cannot end with a vacuum in Gaza.
It has to end in a way that makes sure that there are clear, coherent, achievable plans for Gaza's governance, for its security, and of course, to start to help people to rebuild their lives that have been so decimated and destroyed.
One of the Palestinians whose life has radically changed and wants accountability is Dr. Mohamed Abu Selmeya. The director of Al-Shifa Hospital was released early Monday after being in Israeli custody since November. He says prisoners were subjected to severe torture and his little finger was broken. He was repeatedly hit on the head until he bled. He says there was almost daily torture in Israeli prisons.
We were subjected to severe torture. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
So for the DRC government, according to Mr. Shabani, what they want is that Rwanda leave the DRC area and not a ceasefire by M23.
That was reporter Jafar Al-Katanti in Goma in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Details coming up. Also, shelling by Sudanese paramilitaries has killed five people outside one of the last medical facilities in Omdurman. And UNICEF says the number of displaced people from Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo has surged. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The alliance of rebel groups in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo have declared a humanitarian ceasefire starting today. In a statement, the group, which includes M23 rebels, cited humanitarian reasons for the ceasefire after capturing territory in eastern parts of the country. To brief us on the latest, I talked to reporter Sabiti Jafar Al-Katanti in Goma.
Yesterday, the spokesperson of M23, Lawrence Kanyuka, released a communique saying that the M23 has decided to unilateral ceasefire for the humanitarian reasons so that IDPs and other people can get help from humanitarians. And in the same communique, they also called upon the FAMI-DRC, which are the armed forces from the SADC country, to leave the country because, according to M23, their mission has fallen and doesn't have any interest to. They don't have any interest to stay in the country.
As far as this unilateral ceasefire for the region, has Kinshasa responded in any way, shape or form?
Exactly. The Minister of Interior Affairs of DRC, Mr. Jacquemain Shabani, said in some hours after the communique of M23 that they use to the liars of M23 because it's not the first time that M23 announced ceasefire. So for the DRC government, according to Mr. Shabani, what they want is that Rwanda leave the DRC area and not a ceasefire by M23.
With this ceasefire, M23 has actually said that it does not intend to seize Bukavu or any other cities in the eastern part of the country. They are not going to advance to Kinshasa anymore.
That's a difficult question to answer because I will let you know that a city like Masisi was taken by M23 during a ceasefire, which M23 was also about to respect. But the problem of this war is both parties are not respecting the ceasefire. And saying that they don't want to continue on Bukavu, this I can't be sure because, as I said before, this is not the first ceasefire which M23 itself violated. So they can say that and then they attack on Bukavu. And as the city of Bukavu is now really close to them, 60 kilometers only to Bukavu, talking about Kinshasa, they are very far from Kinshasa, some 2,000 kilometers. We can talk about the cities on the east side of DRC and not about Kinshasa now.
And lastly, Jafar, the rebel announcement of this peace deal comes ahead of a joint summit this week by the regional blocs for Southern and Eastern Africa, which have called for a ceasefire. Kenya's President William Ruto said the presidents of Congo and Rwanda will attend. Will outside pressure help in the construction of the peace process?
Maybe. But the problem still, the position of the two fighters between FRDC, the government of DRC, and the M23, because the government of DRC still keep its position to say they won't talk with M23. They prefer to talk directly with Rwanda, which is the boss of M23. On its side, M23 say they can't accept any peace talks without them, because they are the actor. No one can talk on their place. These two protagonists must sit together talking. If it's Rwanda, but some representative of M23 must be there. Fortunately for Kinshasa, they can't talk with terrorists, as they qualified M23 as a terrorist group.
VOA reporter Sabiti Jafar Al-Katanti, he talked to me from Goma. UNICEF says the number of displaced people from the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo has surged because of the fighting between DRC forces and M23 rebels as they battled for control of Goma. Jean-Francois Bass, UNICEF's DRC acting representative, says families have abandoned large displacement camps just north and west of the city and have now moved to places in the center of the town. He tells VOA's Carol Van Dam gunfire in Goma has subsided significantly since Monday.
That rebel group is tied into these regional dynamics that go back to that crisis. About a third of the rebels that prosecuted the war in Uganda, Museveni's rebels, were of Rwandese or Rwandan ethnicity. And then there were migrants that had fled Uganda in 1959. So about a third of the manpower of that rebellion came from this group. After Museveni seized power, they rose to very senior positions in the Ugandan military establishment, security establishment, as well as the Uganda government and the intelligence. Then when this group invaded, when the Rwanda Patriotic Front invaded their country in 1991, that manpower came from this group that I have just described. And a lot of those people, essentially the Uganda military lost about a third of its force, but also back to this rebellion. A lot of the people who led the organizations that eventually morphed into M23, some of them were actually part of this. That citizenship has always been, at difficult moments in history in these two countries, that citizenship always comes up for debate, and sometimes it is manipulated for political purposes, which then creates a sense of marginalization and a sense of insecurity. Right.
So you're saying like this goes back more than a generation.
It goes back more than a generation. And the only way to solve it is through political, constitutional, legal and legislative measures that has been employed in the DRC as a result of the Sun City Accords, which I participated in. I was working in an organization that was providing technical support to the former Botswana president, Katumila Masire. And one of the elements of the Sun City Accords is precisely this nationality question and how to address and how to pacify the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo by finding a permanent solution to the problem of the citizenship of the Congolese of Rwandan ethnicity. And by the way, they're not just Tutsis. These are Tutsis, Hutus, and Twa. So when we talk about the Banyamulenge, which is the Banyamulenge, these are Congolese of Rwandan ethnicity. No, they're not just Tutsi. They are Tutsi, Hutu, and Twa. So essentially, the M23 has actually grown in scope.
When you were talking about those accords, what happened with those accords when they were trying to reach a peace agreement before, years ago?
The accords were actually successful. I mean, in my opinion, as somebody who was involved with them from day one up to the signing. And they were successful in the sense that they gave Congo a chance, right? The 2006 election, which was the first election that Congo had since independence, were held under the aegis of these accords. And then you had a parliament that was set up. You had a government of national unity. You had a security sector reform that included all elements of the Congolese population and so on. And then you also had the Lusaka peace process. The Lusaka peace process was designed to address the external element of the crisis. So you had Rwanda, Uganda, and Burundi that were supporting the rebellion. And then you had Southern African countries like Angola, there was Namibia, there was Zimbabwe, right, that was supporting the Congolese government.
What is the answer for trying to, you know, address their grievances?
The problem is not the framework. The problem is the political will. So right now we have a situation where the relationship between the Rwandan president and the Congolese president is at an all-time low, to such an extent that they're actually even trading insults. And this is something that we've not seen before. The militias that are supporting the Democratic Republic of Congo government seem to have made the calculation that international pressure just does not apply, and they're not going to bend to international pressure. So,
well, does
the
that worry you? I mean, does that mean
yes,
that we could possibly looking at a regional conflict, a wider regional conflict?
We are potentially looking at a wider regional conflict, because already yesterday we saw some artillery shelling from the DRC side, you know, on Rwandan territory.
That is Jean-Francois Bass, UNICEF acting representative in the DRC. He was speaking to my colleague Carol Van Dam from Dakar, Senegal. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news and our programs by WhatsApp. The number is +1 202 258 3076. We'll be sharing our listeners' comments on African News Tonight. On Chad's border with Darfur, VOA met with refugees who have told harrowing stories of what the United States has described as acts of genocide in Sudan, allegedly by the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. As the refugee called for action, the United States has imposed sanctions on leaders of the RSF and associated militias. Henry Wilkins reports from Adre, Chad.
Nour al-Latif is a refugee who, like hundreds of thousands of others, fled to Chad from Sudan's Darfur region to escape ethnic violence over the last 2 years. She's also a trained psychologist and now spends her days in the refugee camp on the Chad-Darfur border, giving psychological support to victims.
The psychological trauma is overwhelming. The loss of loved ones is immense. Death has become too frequent. Some families have lost both parents. In such cases, the child becomes the caretaker.
Al-Latif says she works with a 14-year-old girl who became head of the family after both parents were killed. VOA spent more than a week in the refugee camp in Adre speaking to victims.
Practically everybody here at the refugee site in Adre has got a horrific story to tell about friends, family members, neighbours being murdered in what the US has called a genocide.
And the US says other crimes against humanity are also taking place. The name of this refugee has been changed and her identity protected for fear of reprisals if she returns to Darfur.
They killed my mother and my brother. They killed them in my house. They killed a lot of people.
She says she was then raped by militias linked to the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. Mohamed Idris Adam, a well-known artist in the Darfuri city of El Janina, says he was on an RSF hit list. He fled the city but left everything he owned, including his life's work, behind.
The whole world condemns violations of human rights, and they have agreements under the United Nations and so on. The people responsible should be brought to trial for the crimes committed in Darfur.
Okay. The US has sanctioned the RSF leader Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo and other senior members of the group. Meanwhile, the victim's trauma continues, says Al-Latif, and for many, it seems to get worse at night.
During the day, they all seem fine, but at night, it's all screaming and chaos in the streets. It's unbelievable.
Although the Darfuris in Adre were lucky enough to escape, they still live with the horror of what happened. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Adre. Chad.
And in the latest from Sudan, shelling by Sudanese paramilitaries killed five people outside one of the last medical facilities still operating in Khartoum's sister city of Omdurman today. A medical source told the French news agency AFP that volunteers at Al Nao Hospital were among the dead in the bombardment by the paramilitary rapid support forces. Gains by the army in Khartoum in recent weeks prompted the RSF to announce a counteroffensive last week. In the western region of Darfur, a military airstrike Monday on South Darfur's capital, Nayala, killed 25 people and wounded 63. On Saturday, at least six people were killed in an RSF bombardment that hit a busy market in Omdurman. On Saturday, President Donald Trump received a call from President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi of Egypt, in which President el-Sisi congratulated President Trump on his inauguration. President Trump thanked President el-Sisi for his friendship and discussed the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. In his first term, President Trump cooperated with Cairo by pressing Ethiopia to reach an agreement on the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. Ambassador Ayman Zainaldin, a former director of the media department at the Egyptian Foreign Ministry, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about what Egypt and other African nations are for Mr. Trump.
Well, we certainly hope that not only this effort would be repeated, but that it would also be seen through until its conclusion, because we certainly hope that America plays effective role in achieving a balanced relationship in managing the water of the Nile to the benefit of all its riparian states, because unfortunately the last effort by the Trump administration ended in a decision to give up the effort completely. Egypt made it clear that it has two principles guiding it in this matter. First of all, fully respecting Ethiopia's right to have its own economic development aspirations and hopes and plans, but also defending very decisively Egypt's rights in the water of the Nile, because it's not something that has to do with Egypt's hopes, but its livelihood. Egypt cannot live without the water of the Nile, which is now way below the minimum needed for survival in Egypt. So this is something that is not negotiable. We can look into ways to help Ethiopia achieve its economic interests, including by using the Great Renaissance Dam, but not in a way that would affect Egypt's water rights. We hope that the strong relations between the United States and both Egypt and Ethiopia could be a catalyst for resolving these issues. Let's hope so. But as I said, this is something that is for Egypt fundamental.
Do you foresee a more U.S. interest in the African continent under a new Trump administration?
This is also an area of uncertainty. There is hope that the United States to maintain its presence globally in face of the other competing major global powers. The United States would want to keep its relationships with African countries and enhance it. That certainly would be something viewed very positively, because there is tremendous economic potential in Africa. If the incoming administration is interested in economic development, certainly Africa offers a lot by way of economic development. We certainly hope that this would be a priority. We didn't see significant messaging coming out of the incoming team with Trump that Africa will have a different, more prominent role in America's foreign policy, but we certainly hope to see that.
The former director of the media department at the Egyptian Foreign Ministry, Ambassador Ayman Zainaldin, he was speaking to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. A dozen people were trapped after a gold mine in western Kenya partially collapsed late Monday. A county police commander in the Kakamega region told the French news agency AFP that there were around 20 miners in the pit at the time it collapsed, but eight have been rescued. He said the search and rescue operation is ongoing and that the police are urging the crowd to stay away to avoid endangering themselves, because he said the area is very fragile. Kenya has a small mining sector compared to its neighbors. However, despite rapid growth in recent years, Much of it is unregulated, with miners having to deal with poor safety measures and organized crime groups. Zimbabwe's traditional stores are struggling to stay afloat as customers flock to informal vendors to buy cheaper products amid a struggling economy. Meanwhile, the government is working to ensure it does not lose critical tax revenue from informal business sales. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
Like other Zimbabweans, 47-year-old Ed Nakatio buys her groceries from informal street vendors in Harare, who usually appear after hours to avoid the police. Katio says these shops are cheaper than the conventional shops. Plus, there are no queues. You pick your items, pay, and then you leave. Economists say traditional stores are struggling to compete with the vendors because Zimbabwe's new currency, the ZiG, or Zimbabwean gold, is fixed at 26.32 against the US dollar. But the money changers say the rate is around 40 ZiG per US dollar on the black market. Street vendor Takuzwa Saki agrees. Saki says the fixed rate makes goods expensive in traditional shops, so shoppers end up coming to buy from us vendors. Unlike informal markets, traditional shops are forced to accept the local currency, and shop owners say they must go on the black market for the US dollar to buy more stock. Economists say the Zimbabwe government is also losing important tax revenue from the informal market sales. Edima Hembe is an independent economist.
There is no country which has developed on the backbone of informal economy. You get to the government cannot have enough revenue to do government duties like your provision of education, provision of health and other stuff. So it's a failure.
Mahembe says retailers and wholesale operators are also struggling in Zimbabwe's economic environment. That includes a volatile currency and taxes, fees and regulations that retailers say make it difficult to stay afloat. Innocent Marimo is with the Confederation of Zimbabwe Retailers.
What we are currently calling for government is to intervene. And particularly our president, Dr. Emmerson Ndambuzo Mnangagwa, to rescue us from this situation that we are currently in, and rescue us of what's left of the formal retail and wholesale sector.
The Confederation of Zimbabwe Retailers has asked the government to formalize the informal sector and create a more equitable environment for all sides. Meanwhile, officials say government agencies are working to register informal vendors. Mishe Gova is Zimbabwe's Commissioner of Domestic Taxes.
We want to increase our tax base and make sure that the fiscus gets what is due to it. We have put up what we call the kiosks. These kiosks are basically they've got laptops and computers where informal traders can get access to our system and register without any challenge.
All informal traders that VOA spoke with said they were not aware of such registration. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Pete Huntley, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.